99% of music artists, if you ask them what their number one commercial success was, and then ask them, did they like it? They would say no. They hated it. They didn't think it was going to be successful. They didn't think it would work. But what did it teach them? It taught them just put it out there. Just let it go. And I think that's the mistake we all make, is we overanalyze, we overthink, we overquestion, we ask everyone else's their opinion. And we beat it up before it even has a chance. But the beauty is just let it go and see what happens.
Take the little bets that don't kill you. So it's like, you know, hey, I want to start a podcast. Okay, well, don't start a podcast. Talk to a friend in a room and tape it with the shitty equipment that you have, which is basically what we did, and then put it out and call it a podcast. And when people say, hey, where's the next episode? Then you go to buy the microphone, you buy the studio, you buy the whatever. It's people think that I kind of preach this, but I don't do it. Every single thing I do has been tested with a cheap bet.
Correct.
Before I've gone in on it. Welcome to the show, Brett. I'm going to give like a quick, and I'll probably miss some brands in here, man, because you're so damn prolific. Bel Air, McQueen, Violet Fog, Bumbu, Villain, Deacon, and of course you sold Ace of Spades to Jay-Z, and Doucet, right?
Yep.
Woo-hoo-hoo! So most people can't do this ever, and you've figured out a way to blend culture, to make a movement around your brands and to make it feel good. I mean, the fact that we're meeting is a testament to your brands, because, you know, in my content, I referenced Ace of Spades and just said, you know, if you don't get this right, guys, you're not going to be at the club popping Ace of Spades like you want to. And someone from your team reached out and I'm like, God, the internet is awesome. I don't really know where to start, because personally, I'm like, you know, how did you get into this space? Usually this space is something, at least I've heard, it's like, it's so hard. Don't even start. Don't even try. You know what I mean? That's what I hear when it comes to spirits.
Yeah. I think my attitude on that is that I've yet to hear of an industry that's really easy. So they're all hard. They're all difficult. There's nothing easy. If it was easy, I don't know an easy industry. There's no question. I think it's really hard, but, I don't know. I think everything is like that.
Are you a lifer in the spirits industry? Are you a marketing guy? What's your background? How did you end up?
I was reading about you. I started out in finance. Right after college, I worked when I went to school. Somehow I got hooked up because a friend of mine, everyone wanted to do the 2-year analyst program at one of the big investment banks.
Sure.
And that was the job everyone wanted. So I got that job. But I have a finance background.
That's awesome.
Nicholas, I grew up in, my dad was the liquor business for 45 years.
Okay.
And so if you sat at our dinner table any night of the week, you know, this is what my dad loved and talked about every day, is this industry. But he didn't want us to join it. There's no way. He loved the fact that I was in finance. Anything, sure. Get away from this industry. Don't do it, Brett. Don't do it.
Right. We want something better for you, son.
100%. No, it's true, though. You want your kids. I got 6 kids. You want your kids doing something that hopefully is easier than you're doing. And I think it's funny because, again, I think I'm evolving, but I realized just recently, you know, I think there's pressure on a parent if you follow in their footsteps, because if you don't, even if you have nothing to do with them, even if you don't make it, they feel bad. It feels bad because they're going to take partial responsibility for that. So I get it.
I think what parents, at least, you know, from my perspective, right? I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to protect you with
100%.
Limited information. So they don't know any better than you do about what you love and what you're good at quite yet. And they're just like, hey, there's this finance thing. This is where people go to get rich. Just do that. All
yeah,
right?
No. And I could hear my dad, God, I can hear him saying, you know, back when I'm 20 years old, yeah, do something where you're not touching anything. It's just money. You know, it's just, you're just dealing with money, you know,
right.
Like, you know, that was his thing. Cause it just seemed easier.
Just go right to the source, right? Why worry about the product? Just touch the money.
Yeah, exactly. And directly. I freaking hated it. I wanted to deal with an actual product. And I, again, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, but when so many people I meet who your parents kind of, they have no choice, but they dictate what you end up doing in some ways, even if you don't want to do it. But when you're around it, you see it, you know, you want to emulate them. You want to be like them. You want to do something similar to them. So, I don't know. I love it. I love it.
It's funny because your dad saying, hey, you know, stay out of the spirits business, keep your hands clean, put on a shirt and tie, you know, go hang out with the guys with the nice haircuts and, you know, and that's where you're going to go make a bunch of money. Really, the best service he could have done is expose you to the liquor business at a young age. And it's funny because clearly you have a serious passion and a serious understanding of this business beyond what anyone could learn in a business school program. So it's funny how sometimes, you know, I want to be like dad. Sometimes it works, that works out wonderfully, as it sounds like it did in this scenario.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I could have been, my issue was, and I say this, I think there's potentially two types of people in the world. One who knows exactly what they want to do, and God bless them, because that's amazing. If you know what you want to do, because you solve the mental anguish that I think a lot of people have. And because I was the opposite, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I wanted to do a little bit of everything. And when you want it, I had lots of ideas. And the problem with that is I never picked anything. So, and it was always this fear that I'm picking the wrong one, and I'm going to waste my time. And my mistake, and everyone's mistake, is always asking people their freaking opinion of, what do you think of this idea? What do you think of this? What do you think of this? So for me, it was, I think I could have been good at anything with respect to the branded space. I really do. I just finally decided one day in my 30s, I got to pick something, enough of this. It was that was one of my moments in life where I said, screw it. I like the liquor industry. I'm going to do it. And I think the one thing that I think I still have going for me in this space is, and I would say this about any industry, is I never worked in it. So that's a good thing, because a lot of times what happens, at least for me, is I think if you're too close to something, you don't see the opportunity. I think if you're too close to it, you start creating these barriers that really don't exist, but the industry puts them up because you've been in it so long, you think that's the case. So for me, I try to continue to this day not be too close to it. I don't want to be around it. I don't want to, because that to me is my why I think we're successful.
That's interesting. Innovating from the outside, right?
100%.
I mean, I think it's Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who's an options trader author. I think he claims that all innovations, major innovations, come from the outside, meaning mathematicians don't push math, physicists push math, right? So it's this idea that once you're in, like you said, you almost start reinforcing the boundaries and problems that you see all around you until they're very real. And you just say, I guess you just can't do that around here. And that outsider mentality, man. Yeah.
I was telling a story today. We need a certain a registration number to ship product from the UK to Vietnam and Korea. It has to do with, it's a UK based product and we're not a UK company anyway. So it's been really difficult with our partner to get this number. And they're telling me that they have current systems in place and the systems won't allow them to do it like this. And they have to figure out how to make the system do it. And they just don't think they can do it. And my response was, well, I could send you a typewriter. You know,
right.
I could send you a pen. Like, just write it down. Like, that's what it is. That's all right. You have to do is just write it down. Like, it's not complicated, but I think in any business, you just start, the bigger you get and the closer you get to it, you start creating, you know, you're not talking about how do we get this done? You're always talking about, well, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to work. You know, you're bringing up the negative. And I think that's where entrepreneurship comes in. That's where new companies come in. You just don't want to hear that stuff anymore.
Well, you don't want to hear it anymore because I think two reasons. It's impeding your progress. And if you've ever broken a rule and it worked out, you don't fucking believe in it anyway anymore.
Correct. 100%.
You're like, yeah, that old wall. Yeah, that thing was rice paper, not brick.
Correct.
Right. So when you build these brands, I mean, is it like, do you feel like you're starting from scratch from the very first? What was the first knock out of the park brand here? Is it Ace of Spades? Is a story before that? What's the chronology there?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. From a successful brand, it's Ace was the first one. I jokingly say this, but I mean it. My first brand, which doesn't exist anymore, is my most successful brand because literally that 5-6 year period of working on that has taught me everything I know about life and my business and how to make success based on complete. And I'm not going to say failure, not failure. It's just based on making mistakes. So everything I'm touting right now is based on that brand. Everything I share, every email I send is based on that brand because I'm holding true to what I've learned in the past. So that to me is, again, I have to think that's a lot of people can say that when they're doing a business is your failure. You know, as long as you have more success than failures, but failure is where you learn success.
That first brand was you stepping out into the wild for the first time, cutting your teeth and going,
it's
now
it's just everything. It's everything from, you know, I didn't trust my instincts. I didn't trust my gut. I relied on other people. I made mistakes in how to build, you know, a sales organization, what type of people to hire, walk before you run. You know, I wasn't doing that. It was more about money than it is about what is success. So, you know, and I could go on and on and on, but all those things are things that I did early on that I don't do anymore. I don't think about it anymore. It's not how you do it. It's not how you build it. To me, success on a brand is a relative term. Success to me is when I ask our importer in a market or a retailer, are you happy with it? As long as they're happy with it, I'm on my way. So I can't force something to happen faster than it can. I don't know how to do that. But if it's working and people are happy, I'm on my way. Because now you're building something. You'll get there. It's just going to be time. And you can't force time to happen faster. At least I can't. It's my money. I don't want to waste it.
Right. Well, it's getting that anecdotal feedback, right? You know, do you look for feedback and before you see it move on the bottom line? You hear it before you see it, the numbers move?
You know, I'm not a soccer player, but there's that expression, you got to keep your foot really close to the ball to control the ball. And that's what you have to do in business, especially at a small brand, small company perspective. So we stay really close to it and pivot constantly. So I think there's a saying I say, it would make sense in my head, but sometimes not having a plan is a great plan. Because if you focus on, if you have a plan and you stick to it for 6, 9 years, a year, and you're wrong day one, and you're not open enough to see that it's not working, you've stuck to it way too long. And that's the bad sign. That's the worst scenario. And I think big companies do that all the time. They make the mistake of just holding to it, and they're not close enough to see what's working and what's not working. So to me, that's part of our success is being really close to the ball so we can see what's working, what's not. How should we pivot? Where should we go? Where should we spend more? Where should we spend less? But it's constantly being really close to it.
Do you know why all the get-rich-quick books fail? They enforce a map that worked for the author that won't work for you. Why are you learning about digital ads when you'd prefer to set up a booth at a trade show and learn from customers face-to-face? Why are you reading about dropshipping when you're passionate about music? See what I'm saying? My book, The Entrepreneur's Field Guide, provides the tools for you to make your own map so you could feel more connected to your work, make money doing something you enjoy, and give back to the people you care about most. I wrote this field guide not only from my own life experience, but from interviewing top entrepreneurs weekly on my podcast. With the tools in the field guide, you simply can't fail. You'll learn about intelligent pivoting, or what I call iteration, why you already have a multi-million dollar idea in your head, and why you can ignore every hot market you think will make you money so you could focus on the things that you actually enjoy. Or as I like to say, it's not never give up. It's never give up iterating on things you like until something works. Get the Entrepreneur's Field Guide right now at nicholascrown.com. Okay, now back to the show.
I think, you know, a lot of questions that I get asked in the DMs is, how do I know when it's working? How do I know, you know, I'm doing my thing. I think I'm doing a good job. How do I know when it's working? And what I'm hearing from you is, even when it's working, you're still iterating and you're still evolving.
You have to. To me, the way I look at brand building, I'm not joking when I say this, is I said earlier, I have six kids in my family. And I think building a business is no different than raising a child. It's the same exact thing. In the early days of a baby, what do? You got to micromanage the shit out of it. You got to take care of them. You're on them 24/7. And as they get, you know, to make sure they don't get hurt, and you feed them and watch them. And then as they get a little bit older, you do a little bit less because they're a little bit on their own. And then as they get older, same thing with a brand. It's the same thing. You got to be all over it, micromanage it, because that's the only way it gets off the ground. And eventually it somebody remembers to reorder it. It looks right on the shelf. It's the right positioning. It's all about a life cycle. And at some point, you know, Bel Air is an example, is probably a teenager right now. You know, it's doing its thing. It's pretty independent, but I got to stay on it because I don't want it to make mistakes. Mm. You know, a new brand like the Deacon we just launched, we're launching in 70 countries. We got to micromanage the shit out of that. We got to make sure that we're the ones making it successful, because no one else will. But I believe that. And I think that's how it works for me. Everyone's different and you can get there different ways. But for me, that's how I think about it.
What are some of the things that you're looking out for in your business? What are some of the things that you're every day you're looking out for these red flags? Is it financial? Is it cultural? Is it messaging? Is it feedback? What are the things that you're on, you know, high alert when you're guiding a brand?
The biggest one is I tell my team that it's up to them, that if they're waiting for our distributors or importers to make a brand successful, they're just going to keep waiting. It's not going to happen. They have to make it successful. They have to get in the market. They have to show the wins. They have to go make it happen. If they do, what happens? Then other people get more confident. Then other people want to get behind it. Then other people want to see it move. But that's something, it sounds so basic, but it's the most important criteria, because it's the biggest mistake I made early on too, is I'm waiting for somebody else to help me. I'm waiting for the distributors to do something. I'm waiting for the retailers to do something. That's critical. And then I'd say this as well, with respect to the trade, again, I'm a consumer product, so we're selling to somebody who's reselling it to somebody, is it's just like a kid. And I tell everybody this all the time. You know, if you send your kids to a friend's house, you want to know who the parents are, right? You want to make sure that those parents will look after your kid and protect them and make sure, you know, if anything goes bad. It's the same way to treat a brand. The same exact way. You want to make sure that brand is going into a place that really does want it and it's not going to half-ass it.
How do you go about building a brand like Bel Air? How do you even start? Because in spirits, to me,
there's so much mythology, and you're going head to head against things that have been around for, quite frankly, fucking 100+ years, right? I mean, they've have their own mythology. So how do you do that now? Do you have a process? Like, how do you build these things? And after that, man, I want to hear how you basically incorporated this into hip hop and a cultural sort of movement.
So from a brand or an idea perspective, it's the same idea for anything we introduce, which is, I think you hit the nail on the head. We're competing with brands that are so old that, to me, they're too old.
Mm.
That they haven't thought differently. They don't think differently. The product is old in the sense that I think from a liquid, because that's where it always starts. If it's not a better liquid than the competition, it's not going to work. It could be the most beautiful package in the world, like Ace of Spades, but if it doesn't taste good, they're not going to come back. And you need that. And for me, that's where it starts and ends. And we're picking categories that we drink, and that, can we come up with something better than the competition that we're after? And in our case with Bel Air, it was Moet and Veuve with a Bumbu. It's the rum category and premium brand, trying to make a premium brand. It's all the same. And we've come up with, to me, better tasting products. And I can put it in someone's hand, let them taste it, and they're going to react. And we're going to get two type of reactions. One, somebody who's never drunk the rum category before, and they're surprised. Wow, I didn't know it could taste like this. And then the other one is from a guy who loves rum. And he's like, wow, this is different. Like, that's the goal. I want a wow factor. I don't want to introduce anything that tastes like something that already exists. It's got to stand out. And there's always story. Story's critical. You want that mythology. You want, you know, with Bumbu, it's named after, in the 14th century, merchants who traveled the West Indies didn't like the taste of traditional rum. And they would drink grog. That's what they call rum. And merchants didn't like it. They would blend their own out of it and add their own spices and characters. And they called it Bumbu. And that's where the brand name comes from. And it's produced in Barbados, the original rum island, which nobody knows. And we don't need to filter the water because the island acts as a natural aquifer. So it always starts there. And then we let it go. And you let it go and see where it can work and how it works. And with all my brands, and I can say this, about all of them, no one's ever believed in them. No one from the industry has ever thought they'd work. They shouldn't work. Bumbu, why are you doing this? Premium rum isn't a thing. Ace of Spades, you're going up against Dom, Cristal, and Krug. It's never going to work. Bel Air, you're launching a rosé first. You put it in a black bottle. That's not going to work. And that's a sign to me that, one, I want to kick their ass and I want to prove them wrong. But two, again, if I like doing things, if something's hot, that's not me. I like doing things that are different. And look, Bumbu is the number one premium rum in the world. We're in 80, 90 countries and we're creating a whole new category that bringing consumers in.
Wow.
But that was based on someone saying it's never going to freaking work, Brad. And that's what I love. So it always starts awesome. There. It's the same recipe.
That's awesome. I mean, to turn the it's not going to work into fuel, I think just that one hot take can change the game for so many would-be entrepreneurs, right? Because if we place our faith and our belief in other people's opinion about what we're doing, they have no fucking idea what we're doing. They don't
Correct.
See what we see, right? So, yeah, I mean, to look at it as fuel, that's really interesting, because really what you're saying is, I see something that you don't see, and you saying it won't work. Oh, I really see something you don't see.
Yeah, I mean, I got a big freaking chip on my shoulder, so I want to kick ass and prove people wrong. But I think that's, in some ways it's a great thing, in some ways it sucks, because it just sucks. But there is, you need to fight for something. And my team is fighting every day, and we have to fight for people's time and space and mental capacity and steal time to get, you know, to get a brand known, because I'm not doing, you know, I once, spoke at a conference at Citibank for disruptive brands. And before I went up on this panel, the guy who was up there before me was this bed company I'd never heard of called Casper, which I'm sure you've heard of.
Yep.
And the panel, the guy interviewing this guy was talking about how in 1 year they're in 7 continents. They're doing $1 billion in sales. It's just this crazy thing. They raised billions of dollars. And I got up there and the first thing I said to my mouth is, if you want to hear that story, that's not me. Like, I don't know how to do that shit. I don't know how to raise money like that. I don't know how to build a company like that. I don't know. I know the slow and methodical way of getting there, and I'll get there. I'm going to buy my way into your hearts and convince you. Me, it's the opposite. I'm not going to buy my way. I believe that you can't buy what we're building, meaning it's cool, but you can't buy cool. Cool is culture. Cool is the streets. Cool is something that came that way down below and started that way. And that's what, it's kind of like street luxury brands. It's street cred. That's what our brands are.
How early on in this process did you plug into hip hop? Was this something you're just like, I listen to hip hop. I love hip hop. I want to work with these guys. I want to get this product into their hands. Or is this something that just happened without one day you open up your computer and there's, you know, your product in a music video? How did that work out?
It all has to do with, and again, I go back to my early days of making mistakes, is lean in on what feels right, what motivates you, what moves you. You know, if I was into country music, that's my beat. That's what I'm going to do. You know, if I was into golf, you know, that's my beat. That's where I'm going to go. So everything to me is we move into things based on it's me, it's us, it's who we are. I love hip hop. I'm probably a bigger fan of the artists than of the music, because I think the artists have a great story to tell. And it's leaning in. So when I see something happening for our brand, so it's a constant relationship where I've decided and we've decided, when people support us, I want to support them. I'm not going to let it go. Even if I don't know them, we'll go after them and try to meet them because they've done something for us. And I think that's what a lot of brands don't do. They run away because they're afraid. You know, oh, maybe they're going to ask for money. Maybe they're going to ask for something. I see just the opposite. They should be asking and I should be supporting.
Right.
So to me, it's a natural extension of who we are. And I'll give you a further extension. And the same thing is, we're really big in Africa right now. We have so much going on in Africa for our brands. And I'm completely in love with Afrobeats music. It's taking over all of Africa. And now we're doing even more in Africa. And now we're producing songs for people. And now we're doing videos for people. But it's just a natural, logical extension that feels right. So it's not forced. It's not a transaction. It's who we are. So it's part of the ethos of what we're trying to do.
It's real. It's not strategy. It's not a bunch of Harvard MBAs in a room going, you know what? We should get this in the hands of Rick Ross. That's the secret to our strategy.
100%. And if I use, and it's such a neat example because I've been doing this for a long time, and most people in my space, they have one, if they have a successful brand, they sold and they're done. So we've had a bunch. But I remember doing Ace of Spades, and this is before Instagram. This is before social media. The way we built that brand is the same it is today, meaning word of mouth and getting people to talk about it. But it was through your traditional media. It was magazines and newspapers, a little bit of blogs. You know, that was the medium. So then we saw Instagram and, okay, now that's interesting. Let's move in this direction. That feels right. That feels like a natural direction. So now you look at our Instagram, we have more followers on Bamboo than Captain Morgan and Bacardi. And they're spending hundreds of millions in advertising. We have more followers on Bel Air than probably any other liquor and wine brand. But that shows me that we're moving in the right direction very naturally, organically. We're not paying people, you know, we're not faking it. It's real. And that's, again, it's a natural evolution for us.
Yeah. I mean, I have this model, right? It's really costly to prop up
a crappy product, right? You've got to pump it. You got to pump it full of money. You got to put it on every billboard to remind people about it. But if you create something magnetic, if you create something that's so unbelievably valuable and it fills you with this emotion, or it's perhaps it's at an incredible price point for the quality, whatever it is, right? And you can't keep people away from it. Well, it's like helium. Your product is just, it's just levitating, right? And this is the magic. And I think this is where, I think if you're going to iterate and you're going to find something to do with your career, this is like, keep going until you hit that. Because it's the other way of propping up a crappy product or an average product, it's going to burn you. It's going to burn your ass. It's going to burn your bank account. It's like, keep going until you get it right, as opposed to build up the war chest of marketing bucks. So you stuff the product on every shelf, whether people like it or not.
Sure. But I think, again, there's tons of examples of spending a shitload of money and being successful. I just don't know how to do that. My way is slower. I think my way is healthy for a brand. I think my way doesn't work for, you know, private equity, because there's a time that they need to get out and they need it. You know, I think if I'm really transparent, as I think about it now, you know, if I had, I'm just using a number, $10 million spent on marketing, I don't know where to spend it. I don't know how to do it, you know, more to spend. You know what I mean? Because it's not familiar with me. It has to be a good spend. It's got to be a relative spend. It's got to be, I'd rather hire $10 million more dollars of people, you know, because I know what I get there and I know what they can do. And I know that's how I can build a brand.
Right. And you're saying, hey, I'm going to keep leaning into the stuff that I know how to do, as opposed to say, oh, I've got all this money, let's start doing shit I don't know how to do.
Correct. and we try, we're learning, you know, we're trying different. I think we're constantly trying new things, but small bets, lots of small bets to see what works. And I think that cuts through who we are, is lots of small bets, and let's figure this out. We'll get there. But again, it all comes back to, what is success? It's a relative term. You know, it's all relative to what you want out of this. I mean, you know, again, Patron, I always joke that I always hear people's pitch to me on brands. You know, if I can just get 2% of the tequila category and in 5 years it's worth X and a multiple of this. And they use Patron as an example. Jesus, Patron's been around for 30, 40 years. It's not like it just happened. But I can tell you, you know, they've had a great run over 20 plus years. That's not such a bad thing either.
These little bets that you're taking, I mean, to me, that's just the strategy for everything. A strategy for your career, strategy for trying, you know, wood shopping new ideas and products. It's take the little bets that don't kill you. So it's like, you know, hey, I want to start a podcast. Okay, well, don't start a podcast. Talk to a friend in a room and tape it with the shitty equipment that you have, which is basically what we did, and then put it out and call it a podcast. And when people say, hey, where's the next episode? Then you go to buy the microphone, you buy the studio, you buy the fucking whatever. It's people think that I kind of preach this, but I don't do it. Every single thing I do has been tested with a cheap bet.
Correct.
Before I've gone in on it.
100%. And that to me is a great lesson to learn, because you're going to see what works and what didn't work. And maybe it worked a little bit and you're going to try it again, and then you're going to change a little bit. You know, I was watching the Michael Jordan series,
The Last
and
Dance,
Phil
yeah.
Jackson said in it, he's, you know, a great line where you got to pivot and pivot quickly. And it's true. I mean, that's what it is. That's, to me, business building is constant pivots, constant trying to, you know, this is a good analogy. And I finally understood it, is it's like a comedian go up on stage and tell a joke for the first time, and he gets a reaction from the audience. And then he goes up the next day and he changes that joke just a little bit. And then he goes up the next day with the same joke, changed a little bit more. It's all based on the audience reaction. It took him 10 times, but that boy, that joke is nailing it.
Yep.
It's the same joke, just a little bit different each time, because he was perfecting it.
And listening to the feedback.
100%. You
know? Okay, I got a 7 out of 10 on that. I got an 8 out of 10 on that. Let's find that 10 out of 10. Boom. Okay. locked it in. That's the joke.
100%. That's and to me, improv. That's improv, and that's what in theory I think that's what we're doing.
It's funny because when you hear the word pivot, right? And you hear Phil Jackson say the word pivot, you go, "Fuck, pivot! Oh man, I had a plan. Now I got to pivot." It's like, well, no, you can take it easy because you didn't know that the first thing was going to work or not work, and you don't know that the second thing is going to work or not work. So you're making guesses. So just lean back, make your best guesses, keep the bet small. You know, to me, it takes a lot of stress off of the whole transaction. When you just the word pivot to me is loaded. But when you really think about it, it's like, well, I don't have a perfect plan. I'm never going to have a perfect plan. I'm going to keep the bet small. I'm going to learn eventually. Oh, okay. It's kind of fun.
And it works. It works. Just put and I think the key is, you know, I talk to artists all the time, and I always ask a musical artist the same question because I'm just so curious because everyone has the same answer. 99% of music artists, if you ask them what their number one commercial success was and then ask them, did they like it? They would say no. They hated it. They didn't think it was going to be successful. They didn't think it would work. But what did it teach them? It taught them just put it out there. Just let it go. And I think that's the mistake we all make. Is we overanalyze, we overthink, we overquestion, we ask everyone else's their opinion, and we beat it up before it even has a chance. But the beauty is just let it go and see what happens. Mm. That's the beauty. We came out with a product. Bel Air has four extensions, so a rosé, a sweeter rosé called a demi-sec, and then we have a brut, a gold, and then a luxe. Then we came out with this product called Bel Air Blue, which was supposed to be limited edition, and one of two things was going to happen. It was either going to work or was it going to work? it's about to become our biggest cuvee.
That's awesome.
But we put it out there, you know, and yeah. And that's the beauty of it. Just let it go.
I think it's on one. Yeah, I love it. Just let it go. Because it's funny when we're iterating, we're saying, I don't know what's going to happen. So I'm going to try a couple things. But the best part is, we'll never know when it's the right thing until the market has an opportunity to play around with it. Meaning like we will never know what the best idea is. And that's a case for, hey, man, just get it out. Get the video out. Get the product out. Get the software out. Just let people play with it because know that you're never going to know how good it is or bad it is until it's in the hands of someone else. And your artist example is the perfect example, right? Yeah. I didn't know what the hit was going to be.
But this is what happens all in my space. You know, again, if I use our rum as an example, I was at a meeting I forgot what country, and the potential importer for us starts out the meeting by saying, "Brad, I've got a whole bunch of stats on dark spirits in the rum category. I want to show you." And I said, "Please don't show me. I know exactly what you're going to show me. You're going to show me how it's not growing. It's not a big category. Brands aren't doing much."
Right.
I said, that doesn't do anything for me. It doesn't do anything. Again, I'm here to set the trend. I'm not here to follow somebody else's trend. So that's my goal. And that's what we do everywhere. So if I use a country like Latvia, which is 1.7 million people, and we'll do like 24,000 cases this year, which is the equivalent of like 800,000 cases in the UK. We're the biggest single rum brand. We're one of every two bottles. It's not a rum market. But the beauty is we're making it. So again, if you're I don't look at data. I don't look at numbers. You just got to go and sell and see what happens. That's if you believe in your product, you're going to convince the consumers.
I mean, I didn't even know they knew what rum was in Latvia. So
they don't. If they and maybe they don't. It doesn't matter.
it's working.
But at the end of the day, and it's interesting. It's the one thing. I was just on an 8-week trip around Europe, visiting different markets, and you know they always say, you know, states are different, countries are different. No, they're all the same. It's all the same. Everybody wants the best product. Everyone wants a good tasting product. They all want a great story to hear and a great story to tell. We all want the same things. So products can be sold anywhere. It's the same. You know, it's why premium brands like Louis Vuitton or Fendi or Gucci work globally or brands work globally. There's no difference. So again, this is where it gets back to our original conversation. The industry you're in tends to overthink everything.
it's like good stuff, value, stuff that makes you feel good is transcendent of borders.
100%.
It's kind of the, it's funny, right? In the spirits magazines, which I know that you don't read at this point, probably, unless to circle some press clippings, it's like you say, oh, you know what's big in Japan now, or you know what's big, and you kind of follow the trends around the world. And if you really pay attention, what I guess you're seeing is, oh man, there's a lot of great mezcal producers that are being discovered. Just happens to be in Japan. You know, it's not that the Japanese have discovered, you know, it's like, oh shit, someone's, it's the word's out in Japan about these great producers, or, you know, or even the rum category. I know very little about this, so excuse me. But the rum category is something that's just been, it hasn't been taken seriously for so many years. So when there's a serious brand that enters the conversation, huh, I didn't know rum could do this.
Correct.
Kind of thing, right?
And there's great examples of that. You know, when I was growing up, Absolut and Smirnoff were your premium brands. Now it's Grey Goose and Belvedere. In tequila, it was Cuervo. And then you needed a brand like Patron. In gin, for years, it was Bombay Tanqueray. Now, you know, it's a brand like Hendrick's. So
right.
All categories need to go, need someone to break the barrier. And it's hard, though, because the biggest difficulty about, again, from a pricing perspective is, oh, it's not going to work. It's too expensive. It's not going to work. It's
no
too
one's going to pay for that
Correct.
Much for rum.
And that's
right.
That's you can do that with any industry, a car, clothing, watches. Oh, it's not going to work. It's too expensive. But you got to have the balls to hold your price and convince people that otherwise.
What does a product launch look like of this scale for you? Is it that small bet? Do you quietly launch these products?
I've never had a launch.
Oh man, I'm jealous.
And again,
dude,
this goes back to my first days. I think a launch to me, life, and again, I take bits and pieces of my life to my business. And life is all about managing expectations. If you have low expectations, life is amazing. And if you set
the
bar
really,
say again?
So never have a launch, because a launch is, oh my God, we're going to throw the party and everyone's going to show up. We're going to sell so much shit. It's going to be amazing. And you're always deflated after
Correct.
A launch.
100%.
I've never had a launch where I go, that was
Correct.
Great.
Again, though, it can work and it does work. But I don't have those resources, nor do I want to try it, because to me, it's going to cost so much more than just the launch, because there's so many other things that go with it that you need to have and put in place. So to me, I'd rather just go sell, start selling, start building the account base, start creating a little bit of awareness, and let's do a party in 3 years.
Right.
We'll come back to it.
Right.
But I just don't believe that consumers run home after and say, oh my God, I tried something and I'm going to go ask for it. I'm going to wait for it to get to my retailer or my account. I'm going to wait for it to come in. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And at least I don't believe that.
Well, it's so arrogant to think that I'm going to throw this amazing party and convince you to stop drinking this other brand that you've been drinking for 20 years and drink mine from now, you know, from ever after, because I threw a big party and there was a fountain and, you know, there were some great acts there. It's an arrogance, and it's kind of fucking hilarious, because you might just say to yourself, have I ever bought something that someone told me to buy, or do I make my own decisions?
Correct. And it's the same way. It's funny as you say that, you're making me realize why, when I taste somebody on our products, I never tell them what they're tasting. Meaning I don't amp it up, because I want them to decide. I want them to come away with what they're tasting, what they're feeling, what they get out of it. And that's the fun part is, you know, they'll taste our rum and I taste banana. Well, there is no banana in it.
Right.
You know, that's fun. Like, they're coming up with their own experience. That's what I want. It's your own experience. It's your own relationship with a brand. I want you to discover it. I don't want to force it on you, because that's the consumer I am. I love finding stuff. And it may have been out for 100 years, but I still feel like I found it. You know, mm-hmm. I found Chrome Hearts 20 years ago, yet it's been around for so much longer. I found Kettle One, but it's been around so much longer.
Right.
Like, I think people like discovering things. I want people to discover my brands, not be forced onto my brands.
I think I'm anti-launcher like yourself, man, because one thing about the launch is funny. The launch presumes that you got it right, which of course we know you've never gotten it right. You're just refining and iterating. So the launch is an opportunity for everyone to find out the things that you didn't get right.
Correct.
I'll give you an example, right? So I've been writing this book and I haven't had a launch. No one knows about it yet. I've just quietly put it out into the market and I got the spine backwards. The artist put the spine backwards. So those who have ordered the book, the text on the spine will face the wrong way until tomorrow when the spine is updated. So if I had such a big launch and everyone rushed to buy my book, they'd buy it with a backwards spine.
Of course. For it's me, again, that's the, you know, life is... it's why my marriage worked out so well. I told my wife to have low expectations, and it's been amazing ever since.
Yeah, I mean, when we have this idea that we're constantly tweaking and getting better, not in like a stressful, you know, what's the movie Hero Dreams of Sushi, where like every day, every cut of fish is, you know, you just like are obsessing over, but in a way that like, hey, this is never going to be perfect. We're always going to be refining it. I think there's a state, there's a lot more fun in that, right? I mean,
this is where micromanaging can be a bad thing because you're too into it. You got it. You have to let go. You have to let things happen on its own. You got to let things breathe. You got to let other people do things. So there's that fine line. How do you do both and make it work? You know what I mean?
How does that work for you?
From a business perspective, it's one of the most difficult things is letting go. So I hear I'm saying micromanage, but micromanage means you don't let go.
Are there brands that you feel as though are, you know, you mentioned Belair is at kind of like a teenage level. Is this something where you can take your hands off the handlebars a little bit and your team is...
Oh, no, there's no question we have because a brand gets big. It just, you know, it gets big. So it's on its own. But then the beauty is you learn from it. So in Korea, we're the number one bubbles in Korea, which is amazing.
Wow.
In Vietnam, we're the number one. In Africa, we'll soon be.
That's
so
unbelievable.
It's then it becomes, well, what happened in Korea to make this happen? What happened in Vietnam? So you start... Mm. The goal is to learn from each of those examples, you know, and how to replicate that. So to me, it depends on the market and where we are, what's happening. And it's trying to transfer the good and make that replicate that in as many places as you can.
It's just incredible because you have ultimately a product that you... Everyone could make a good case. It's impossible to dispel these other brands in these other countries. They have a point. They've got all the data to point at. I mean, to me, this is just the ultimate inspiration for anyone working on a challenge because it doesn't matter. If you see something different and you execute it and you're willing to be open-minded, you could become the number one bubbly in Korea. I mean,
correct. Correct. But it's also in my mind and the way we do things, it's a little bit, again, it depends on the brand. But for me, I think our brands are global. I think because they're premium and I think our consumer is the same consumer everywhere. So if I'm in New York drinking my scotch, the Deacon today, and I go to Paris tomorrow, I don't change brands. I want the same brand. Mm. If I go to Athens the next day, I want the same brand. So I tend to think globally, and at the same time, again, not every market's going to be the same. So Bumbu, our biggest market in the world is Canada, outside the U.S. No one from our company's ever been there. And it's word of mouth.
Shout out to Canada.
Yeah, but that's where you just got to let things go and see and learn, you know, what works and what doesn't work. There's an artist, I always tell this story, there's a great artist named Russ. And Russ was telling me that he, you know, put his music out on SoundCloud. And what he'd do is just watch. he'd watch where he'd have fans and where they're listening. And he noticed there were, he's got fans in Washington, the state of Washington. So what does he do? He goes to Washington and he starts cultivating those fans. And then he sees he's got fans in the Middle East. They all think he's Middle Eastern, but he's not. He's from Jersey. But he's cultivating fans in the Middle East and he's building around his base. And that's, to me, that's being on the ball. That's being close to it. That's watching what's happening and learning from it. And then leaning in on what's working, you know, and when it's not working, move back. We've got a brand like Bel Air. There's a saying in our industry, if you've never heard this, you build it on premise, which is bars and restaurants, to sell it off premise retail. So I thought when we launched Bel Air, it would be a big on premise nightclub brand similar to A's. But retail loved it. Retail loved it, and we just leaned in, and we're enormous at retail, haven't even started on premise. But had I held on to this fixation that, boy, the industry says you have to do it this way, and boy, I got to stick to this plan, I would have fucked it up.
Right. That's interesting. So even when it starts to work in a way that's unusual, let it keep working.
Who cares?
Don't bring in the MBAs to fuck it all up, right?
Who cares? Again, it always gets back to people tend to overthink things. Just, you know, where it's working, lean in on it. Where it doesn't work, move on.
I mean, we just relocated. I was in South Beach, and we just relocated to Chicago. I mean, our biggest market for our content is New York, Chicago, and LA. I love Chicago, right? So we're here in Chicago. And the whole atmosphere is different, and it's so supportive. And you see everyone on the streets, and you're hugging people. You know, on the show, we've got access to awesome local entrepreneurs and just fun people. And it's been absolutely enormous. People say, like, "Hey, Nick, well, why would you move from South Beach, where it's living's good and the weather's great, to Chicago?" I'm like, "Well, Chicago's great, man. Food scene rocks. Everyone's cool as hell. I fucking love it here." Yeah.
When you do things that make you happy, everything else works.
I get it. That's the, I feel like that's the thumbnail for the episode.
I wish there was someone like me for me when I was younger in the sense of I like telling the shit side of stories because, so I started this series called Self-Made a bunch of years ago, and that's our motto. If you ask me, like, what's the ethos of the company and the brands, it's this concept of self-made. Because when I see people holding our bottles, I feel like they've done something, they've achieved something, they've created something. And what motivates me personally is I don't like hearing people's success stories. I like hearing people's the shit stories that they went through. Because if I'm talking to you, you're successful. And that's what I really like. So to me, that empowers the young Brett who just feels like, Jesus, it looks so easy for everybody else, but it's not. You know, I lost my house. I stopped paying my mortgage to put all my money back in the business. I had a marshal come and take my house. I had the IRS through my bank account because I stopped paying my taxes because it allowed me to put more money back in the business. I had investors. They wanted to blow up the company. It sucked, but I think that's the most important side to share because it's not easy and you go through shit and you know what? You come out the other side too. So
right.
Both can happen. Both can happen and you can get there.
It's so much more if you're offering, you know, you assume that, hey, packaging these conversations it's valuable. And to me, it's so much more valuable to hear the real shit story as 100%. Opposed to the pop and bottle story, which is great. You know, if you're, like you said, if you're on the show, things kind of worked out, right?
Already. Exactly. Exactly.
So we know that
but
part.
I'm an outsider, but if you're watching me, you know, and you don't know me, you think, Jesus, it was so easy. No, it wasn't. It sucked. You know, it was not good. It was hard. It was difficult. There were horror stories. You know, my first big purchase was two air conditioners because we had no AC in New York. We pretended my house was my office. And we pretended it was an office. Like it was comical. But that's the best side because that's the real side. Like that's what happened. That's, You know, the first, as I said, the first 6 years was just constant learning, constant mistakes, constant waste of money. But that's how why I'm here, is those, I needed that.
My computer just blew up. So,
no, but it was, to be honest, it was a perfect time to end.
I mean, I was loving it. The first big purchase was the air conditioner. Look, man, I appreciate you coming on and sharing
this story.
Yeah, no,
I appreciate it. Really nice. Really nice talking to you. Anything I can do, please ask. Let us know when it comes out, and I hope it adds value.
No, totally. I think everyone needs to hear these stories and see how, you know, how an authentic brand is built from just genuine interest, you know, and it's not this... wasn't this woodshop to MBA type of thing where, yeah, let's bring in these great artists. You love these artists. So it feels very, very genuine. And this was a great conversation, man. I appreciate it.
Love it.